Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's session is entitled Understanding Autoimmunity and Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Roberta Peche, and I'm the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on the support, advocacy, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. Hosting today will be Chitra Krishnan, Executive Director of the TMA. Before I turn it over to Chitra, a few housekeeping pieces. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. And during the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thank you, Roberta. I'm honored to introduce our guest today, Dr. Benjamin Greenberg. He is the director of the Transverse Myelitis and the NMO Center at University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, and Dr. Carlos Pardo, who directs the Transverse Myelitis Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Pardo was one of the co-founders of the Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center in 1999. Dr. Greenberg trained at Johns Hopkins Neurology under Dr. Pardo and several others, and after finishing his training, he started the center at UT Southwestern. Thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you to all our listeners for joining us, and thank you for sending us your questions as well. To start us off, Dr. Pardo, can you give us an overview of what we understand to date about these rare neuroimmune diseases? Is the medical community certain that TM is caused by an autoimmune response?
Thank you, Chitra. Thank you, Roberta, for inviting me to this podcast, and it's really an honor to be with the Transverse Myelitis Association and working with all of you in these issues. So the main issue is neuroimmunology, neuroimmune diseases, and autoimmunity. And let me start with a couple of definitions. What is a neuroimmune disease? Neurological diseases are produced by different factors, are produced by damage of blood vessels, may be produced by infections may be produced by trauma, but immunity and the way that the immune system in our body reacts against the brain or spinal cord is one of the frequent causes of neurological disorders. And transverse myelitis, despite a rare neurological disorder, is one of those neuroimmune disorders that is associated with immune reaction against the spinal cord. So rare neuroimmune disorders have a very wide spectrum of manifestation. Neuroimmunological disorders associated with immunological reactions may produce damage of the brain, may produce damage of the retina in the eye, may produce damage of the optic nerve, may produce damage of the spinal cord. In the case of the spinal cord, some of the cases associated with transverse myelitis are linked with neuroimmunological responses and autoimmunity. And I think that that is where we need to understand in the context of transverse myelitis. So transverse myelitis, as the name say, is an inflammation of the spinal cord. And that inflammation may come from different sources. Inflammation may be associated with a viral infection, like happened in cases of poliomyelitis, for example. Damage of the spinal cord may come from post-infectious disorders, such as inflammation of the spinal cord that may happen after infectious, like flu, like West Nile virus encephalitis, or other type of viral infections. Those are problems in which the immune system is overacting and is producing an inflammatory damage of the spinal cord. So what is autoimmunity? Autoimmunity is one of those mechanisms in which the immune system, for a known reason, trigger abnormal inflammatory response against their own body. In this situation, the immune system may damage the spinal cord, may damage the brain, or may damage the optic nerve. So the factors that trigger autoimmune diseases are really unknown. And in the case of rare neuroimmunological disorders, one of the suspects is an infection. An infection initially may prime the immune system to react against a viral or bacterial infection, and later that immunological reaction may produce a friendly attack against the spinal cord, for example. And that is very well known in some patients with the transaminitis in which a previous history of infections is frequently associated with the onset of the myelopathy or symptoms of myelitis. So the term transaminitis doesn't mean that all the cases associated with transaminitis are linked with autoimmune disorders. There are many patients with transaminitis in which the cause of the myelitis is not necessarily an autoimmune disease, but rather the effect of an infectious process. Happen frequently with herpes virus, happen frequently with West Nile virus, and may happen with all the other sort of reactions. So I basically wanted to introduce the term autoimmunity in the context of transaminitis to explain that despite we are always concerned about autoimmune responses in transaminitis, only a fraction of those patients with transaminitis are affected by autoimmune disorders.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Parker. That was a great explanation. So, Dr. Greenberg, given sort of the diversity of these diseases, given the complexity of understanding and diagnosing them, what does that future look like? Can we ever find biomarkers, for example? I mean, are stem cells ever going to be an answer, for example?
Yeah, so given the complexity, we do have some challenges ahead. And like Carlos, I just want to take the opportunity to thank you and Roberta and the TMA for hosting these sessions. I hope they're helpful to everyone. I find them always educational for myself, and it's always good to listen to Carlos describe things. I continue to learn things as I work with him, and I think he's right on a lot of fronts that I just want to echo. That is the category of conditions we call transverse myelitis and rare neuroimmunologic disorders are very heterogeneous. And I think what we are missing, that the real complexity is that we have lumped people in to a common category of conditions who probably have various underlying causes. But even though the triggers may be various, the cascade of events that lead to damage have overlapping pieces to it. And the reason that's important is the same therapeutic interventions may be helpful to a whole host of different causes of transverse myelitis or different causes of spinal cord damage. So whether the trigger is an infection that's gone or an infection that's active, some of the treatments may be beneficial to both. And this complexity, however, limits our ability to match people with the best treatment and our ability to have a perfect crystal ball in terms of prognosis. And so I think really where the future is going to go is on separating out the conditions that we have classically lumped together and understanding at a molecular level the differences between them. And that's been a difficult goal to achieve, but we are chipping away at it. And so as I think we get better diagnostics for separating patients into more refined categories. Why does one patient with transverse myelitis recover better than another? As we understand the biology underlying the injury and recovery, I think we will be far better able to treat and prognosticate for patients. So you raise the issue of biomarkers. These are findings on imaging or by blood or spinal fluid that teach us about what has happened and what is happening to a patient, and they have been completely lacking in transverse myelitis. I think as we discover and refine those, our abilities to treat patients is going to be significantly improved.
That's great. Thank you. We received many questions from our community on the disease and mechanism of autoimmunity, which is today's topic, but we also received questions on recovery, management, and treatment. So we'll do our best to address as many questions as we can, but I want to let our listeners know that we're planning future podcasts exclusively focused on treatment, neuropathic pain, and recovery in case we're not able to get through all the questions in the next 45 minutes. So our first question, there are actually two questions, one from the States and one from London. And I'm going to give this to you, Dr. Pardo. They had a lot to do with gradual onset or slow onset of the disease. Do you see this a lot? And part two of this question is, you know, we say get steroids and other treatments to stop inflammation as soon as possible. So how does this work with gradual onset?
That's a very interesting question, and that is related with the heterogeneity and variability in the presentation of transaminitis that Ben was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The cause of transaminitis is quite diverse. We may have infectious disorders that come and show up very quickly, so the manifestations are going to be very fast in a matter of hours or few days. We have autoimmune disorders, those disorders that are associated with presence of a previous rheumatological diseases like psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's disease, in which the underlying autoimmune disorder may set up a very slow progressive set of symptoms and clinical manifestations. Or we may have the result of autoimmune disorders that are triggered by previous infections in which the installation of symptoms is going to take a while, a matter of a few days or perhaps weeks. So it depends not only, the time frame of evolution of symptoms depends not only of the cause of the transaminitis, but also depends of the host, in this situation, the patient, because every patient may react differently to different type of triggering factors or different type of immunological factors. So the other important issue is location. We frequently have specific disorders that affect some areas of the spinal cord. When patients have areas of the spinal cord that are associated with sensory function, some of the symptoms actually evolve very slowly as compared with factors that damage motor function, in which the patient realizes very quickly that there is something abnormal, something wrong, because they are losing motor power, motor function. So the summary of the question and the answer to the question is the time frame of evolution of symptoms depends not only of the cause, but also the factors associated with the patient, immune system, and neurological system.
That's great. Thank you. This question comes from Huntsville. Can an MRI or any other scan conclusively show destruction of anterior horn cells? Or is this a theory based on specific symptoms like functional loss? We have heard this theory from three different neurologists. The diagnosis is idiopathic TM. Do you want to take this, Dr. Pardo?
So it's a very challenging situation. And as a clinical neurologist that we are, we always pay attention to the clinical manifestations. And every time that our patients come to our office, we pay a lot of attention to the clinical examination.
Mm-hmm.
Those approaches are the most important aspects of defining what part of the spinal cord is affected. Neuroimaging and magnetic resonance imaging are very valuable tools for assessment of our patient population. However, those are still with a resolution that is unable to define clearly what part of the neuronal cell population is affected. We are able to predict an involvement of anterior horn cells just with a neurological examination. An MRI obviously is going to help us to confirm the clinical assumption. So it's extremely important from clinical and imaging correlation point of view that what we see in the clinical examination match with the MR findings. So the MRI, as a summary, the MRI is helpful, but probably is the most important aspect in the diagnosis to establish damage of anterior horns or motor function is what we see in the neurological examination.
Great, thank you. This is for you, Dr. Greenberg. There were several questions, actually I'd say six or seven questions, that talked about the relationship between vaccinations like shingles. One of them mentioned Menectra, or severe allergy to poultry, previous hyperactive autoimmunity like urticaria, psoriatic arthritis, questions about genetic, environmental. We hear this all the time. Do these have any relationship that we've been able to show even causative to the onset of the disease? And if yes, do we know if there is a time frame that is critical? And does this make anybody who has an underlying autoimmune condition vulnerable?
So you're right, we do get this question all the time, and really at its heart is the notion of triggers. And so our best understanding for autoimmune conditions is that an individual will have a pre-existing propensity or susceptibility to develop the disease. Now that susceptibility is made up by a lot of different things. Part of it is genetics. Some people are genetically predisposed to autoimmune disorders. Part of it's environmental. So certain exposures we have, whether they be toxic exposures, infectious exposures, nutritional exposures, can make you more or less predisposed to an autoimmune disease. And then at the time of the stars of lining, whatever final trigger sets things over, there are different states of biology that you could be in that would make you more or less likely to have an autoimmune disorder. The best example we use is vitamin D deficiency. There's some data to suggest that vitamin D deficient individuals, especially if you're vitamin D deficient during certain parts of your life, may be more prone to developing an autoimmune disease after exposure to the exact same trigger as somebody who is not vitamin D deficient. And there's a variety of pieces of evidence to support this, but none of it's conclusive. And the reason we kind of hem and haw about it is partly back to the complexity that Dr. Pardo and I were discussing at the beginning. Let's say there is a specific trigger for immune-mediated transverse myelitis. And let's say it's developing the autoimmunity after an infectious exposure. Well, if we are not separating out those cases in a study, so let's say we have 1,000 patients and 700 of them, who've all been diagnosed as transverse myelitis, but 700 of them had post-infectious transverse myelitis and 300 of them had a different cause of transverse myelitis. When I do the epidemiologic study about what was the risk factor or the exposure, I'm never going to be able to determine it because I'm mixing two different diseases in the same study. And so the reason there's a lot of hand-wringing and unclear answers when it comes to the triggers gets back to the diagnosis. If we're lumping multiple diseases into the same category, it makes it very hard to find the cause because in reality we're looking for multiple causes simultaneously. We've done some analysis over the years looking at vaccinations, and this is probably the biggest question I get asked in clinic over and over again. Number one is, did a vaccine cause my transverse myelitis? And number two, I've had transverse myelitis. Is it safe to get ongoing vaccines? And in general, with very rare exceptions, the answer is we don't see conclusive evidence linking vaccination to causation in transverse myelitis. And number two, we advocate, at least in my clinic, for ongoing vaccinations even after having a presumed autoimmune event of transverse myelitis. And we have very good data for that from a variety of studies looking at people with established autoimmune disorders who very safely undergo vaccination without ongoing autoimmune events. And so we tend to be proponents of vaccination, and I think the data overwhelmingly supports that. And we also note for our folks who've had TM, let's say the issue was actually an infection. You want to reduce your exposure or at least your response to unbridled infections. And so getting vaccinations may actually be protective from future complications.
So in the case of infection, and this is actually a question we got from Las Vegas, so when it's an infection and the infection is no longer present, can the effects of TM you know, paralysis from the waist down, for example, be reversed in any way?
Yeah, so the issue there is, so let's say an infection causes the symptoms. The way it does it is through damage to the spinal cord, and there's two ways to damage the spinal cord. One is the infection itself invades the cells of the spinal cord and causes cell death, as well as triggers inflammation that may further the damage. The second way an infection can trigger damage to the spinal cord is you can have an infection somewhere else in your body, in your lungs, in your throat. You get, I'm getting over a cold myself, so I fought off a virus last week. My immune system, while hunting for that virus throughout the body, can accidentally go into the spinal cord and cause damage because it's confused. Now, in both of those situations, the symptoms a person has is because of the damage that's been done. And the mechanism of the damage actually matters far less. Whether or not you got shot or stabbed or fell off a diving board, had transverse myelitis, or an infection of the spinal cord, once the damage is done and the cause of the damage is done, the symptoms remain because of the scar tissue that's left behind. And so there's a lot of overlapping therapies between the different causes of spinal cord damage, whether they be inflammatory or not. But unfortunately, if there is an infection, once it clears, we're still left with the same issues, trying to fix damage that has occurred. And I'll make one comment here, and Carlos might correct me on this. I'll tell you what my suspicion has been relative to infections. If I take all the patients we've seen in whom we have diagnosed transverse myelitis, I suspect that a primary infection of the spinal cord has been the cause in the minority of patients, that the majority of people in whom I'm convinced have had inflammation within the spinal cord. I am more convinced that it is a post-infectious event versus a primary infectious event. But I can't prove that. That is an unprovable, at this stage, theory.
I agree completely with that statement. I think that we always look for viruses. We are always in look for something that we are able to treat. And frequently we come with empty hands, particularly when we are thinking about infection. And in our experience here in the acute setting with patients with transverse myelitis is only a small number of patients really experience a direct infection of the spinal cord. And most of the patients with transverse myelitis experience is just post-infectious inflammation. And subsequently, that may be assumed to be an autoimmune mediated mechanism rather than infectious mechanism.
And going back to sort of your initial introduction, Dr. Pardo, where you talked about, you know, the multiple causes that we can have, and you reinforced this, Dr. Greenberg, we have a question from Connecticut. This person says, I have two lesions between C2 and C4, left me paralyzed from the neck down for a month, and 3 years later I continue to have many deficits. Could a multinodular goiter be the cause? As I understand, it is not common to have a cervical attack. Perhaps you can share sort of what the prevalence is between a lesion in the cervical spine versus the thoracic spine, and is this uncommon to see, and could there be a relationship between goiter?
I will answer the question related with the goiter. Goiter is basically an abnormality of the thyroid gland, and frequently these abnormalities are associated with, in some way, some immune disorders. The link and potential etiological effect of the goiter and the spinal cord is really not proven, and I don't believe that there is any causality. Mm-hmm. However, it's very interesting that there are some thyroid disorders that are associated with autoimmunity, like Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Again, the fact that there is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, that doesn't mean that automatically it will explain presence of a spinal cord inflammation. In the particular situation of the patient that is asking this question, in which there are two lesions that are separated topographically, it will be very important to clarify if there is any other underlying autoimmune disorders. When we see in the clinical profile that there is dispersion in time, meaning that symptoms come in different time points, or there is evidence of a topographic distribution that suggests that there are two or three different lesions, it's extremely important to clarify if there is no evidence of any demyelinating disease or any other of the autoimmune disorders like neuromyelitis optica. So many times in the clinical setting, the clinical profile, the pattern of clinical presentation, the temporal profile, and the topography of the lesions give us clue about causes and to make sure that we answer the question about relationship with goiter, it's very unlikely that there is a relationship or causality, but I wonder if there is any other underlying autoimmune and background, like in multiple sclerosis or neuromyelitis optica.
Great, thank you. And talking about neuromyelitis optica, this, I wonder if Dr. Greenberg, you can take the next question. This comes to us from Bristol, Virginia. In NMO, disease progresses only during attacks, yet in between attacks, tests for aquaporin 4 antibodies can still be positive. How is it that the antibodies present between attacks do not immediately trigger another attack or keep the attack going?
Yeah, so this is a great question, whoever figures it out first, please call me and we'll split the Nobel Prize on this. So we know that in neuromyelitis optica, the majority of patients test positive for an antibody known as the anti-aquaporin 4 antibody. So just to take a step back, antibodies are proteins that your immune system makes to fight off infections. Yet in neuromyelitis optica, by mistake, the body has produced this protein, this antibody that attaches to certain cells and can either cause the cells to function poorly or can trigger a set of cruise missiles to go in and destroy the cells. So these antibodies cause a lot of problems. But the mere presence of the antibody in a person's system, in a person's blood, is not enough to cause damage. The antibody has to get to its target, attach to its target, and trigger a cascade of other events that ultimately lead to the destruction and damage of spinal cord, brain, or optic nerve tissue. And so we were working collaboratively with a group of scientists, including those at Hopkins, San Francisco, and all across the world, to understand what are those sequence of events that lead to the destruction. Because frankly, having an antibody in your blood is not a problem. It's when it gets triggered to attach to cells and cause damage that's the problem. So it opens up a whole new avenue of therapies. We may not have to get rid of the antibody. We may just have to block its ability to activate a whole host of events that lead to damage. And just to get everybody on the podcast thinking even further, I'm not sure how many listeners we have, but I'll confuse things even further or give you something to ponder over a drink tonight. And that is the target of that antibody, the aquaporin 4 molecule, which leads to damage to the optic nerves, spinal cord, and brain, is located on a whole host of tissues throughout the body. You can find this protein in the lungs. You can find it in the kidneys. You can find it on certain blood cells. And yet those organs are not affected by neuromyelitis optica, as best as we can tell. Yet the antibody can attach to that protein any time. And so we know that merely having the antibody is not enough to cause a disease. And this is true pretty much for every antibody-mediated condition. And Carlos can correct me if I'm wrong. But if you look at myasthenia gravis, if you look at Hashimoto's thyroiditis, if you look at any of the classic antibody-mediated diseases, the attacks and events are separate from the antibody being in your system. So the antibody is necessary but not sufficient to cause the damage, and we're trying to fill in the gaps.
That was a great explanation. Thank you. And just to sort of, there were a few more questions that I'm going to throw them out there, but I think you've already addressed them. There was a book written called The Autoimmune Epidemic by Donna Jackson Nakazawa, And she talks about the hypothesis that environmental chemical toxicity is a cause of autoimmune disorders. And there's a separate question talking about medications and transverse myelitis, like a blood pressure medication, and a third question about repetitive strain injuries being a trigger. Do you think these are all plausible, Dr. Greenberg?
Well, at this stage, I'd say anything's plausible. I think we have to have an open mind about triggers. And what I encourage people to consider, so I think there are likely environmental triggers for these conditions. Medications, I'm not as sure about because of the number of people who take, for example, blood pressure medications or others is so high. And we're not seeing epidemiologically, I think, the same link, although it's an understudied area. In the end, unfortunately, I think people need to embrace the complexity of autoimmune disease relative to triggers. I don't think there's going to be a magic bullet. I don't think we're going to discover that it's purely the chemicals used at the dry cleaners. Are they helping our health? Probably not. Are they good things for us to absorb into our bodies? I'm going to go ahead out on a limb and say no. Are they the root cause of the skyrocketing numbers of autoimmune diseases in the world? I don't know if they're the root cause because, like we mentioned earlier, autoimmune disease is the summation of a series of events. You can expose 100 people to the same dry cleaning chemical, and they're not all going to get an autoimmune disease. Maybe one will, but they didn't get it because of the dry cleaning chemical. It was the combination of the chemical with their lack of vitamin D, with the right infectious exposure at the right age, and the right genetic background. It's an incredible jigsaw puzzle that has to be put together. And complicating things further, you can take 10 people with the same autoimmune disease, and they may have had 10 different triggers. Because there are lots of different ways to confuse an immune system, and we can do this in the lab 10 different ways. Mother Nature is a lot more creative than we are. So I encourage people to strike a balance between recognizing that all of these theories out there have some plausibility to them, but the circumstantial evidence that gets presented in a lot of different publications, whether they be books or articles, really just feed upon circumstances and not scientific evidence. And the reason that's important, I don't have to have scientific evidence for everything I do. In fact, most of what I do does not have scientific evidence. But when we're making large public health decisions, when we're making large investments of time and resources, trying to make those decisions, we have to have a basis for it. And you can make a plausible theory for a lot of different things to trigger these diseases. It's going to take a tremendous amount of work to put those individual pieces together.
Absolutely. That's great. Thank you. Dr. Pardo, I know you hear this, and I know we hear this, and I know, Dr. Greenberg, you hear this, fatigue. Do all autoimmune disorders cause fatigue? And if so, are the characteristics of autoimmune fatigue sufficiently unique that it could be a leading indicator of autoimmune problems?
Very, very interesting question. In general, the majority of autoimmune disorders have associated fatigability as part of the symptoms. There are, however, other type of factors that influence fatigability. Let me dissect this a little bit. Why an autoimmune disorder is frequently associated with fatigability. One of the potential explanations is that some of the immunological factors, the immunological mediators, may affect brain function, and that may translate in presence of fatigability. However, in my experience, and I believe in the experience of the majority of clinicians, there are other factors that probably are more prevalent for presence of fatigability. For example, patient with multiple sclerosis, patient with transverse myelitis, patient with rheumatoid arthritis experience pain. And that pain is frequently a factor that influences lack of sleep. And if a patient is unable to sleep normally because there is a lot of pain at night, or your patient is waking up in the middle of the night, that is enough to produce a lot of fatigability next day. So it's important to separate these issues because those are issues that may be treatable. If a patient with transverse myelitis is not sleeping well because needs to wake up in the middle of the night 3 or 4 times to go to the restroom because the bladder dysfunction problems. That is something that may be targeted and treated by the physician. We can treat bladder dysfunction in the majority of cases, and we are able to improve them, the ability of this patient to sleep. Another frequent cause of fatigability is the energy that is being consumed by patients with transient myelitis. I mean, many of our patients have a lot of motor dysfunction, and frequently there is a lot of problem with the good preservation of energy and the management of that energy, and that obviously is going to produce a lot of fatigue, and it's going to produce symptoms that are going to be translated with a constellation of problems. So the summary of the answer is, yes, autoimmune disorder frequently has fatigue as an associated symptom, but in addition to the autoimmune disorder, there are several other factors that are probably more important and more interestingly that may be treatable for modifying that type of symptomatology.
Great, thank you. I actually have a few NMO-related questions. I wonder if I might pose them to you, Dr. Greenberg. This one actually just came through on our Facebook page. This is from Rosanna in New Jersey. Her son has both NMO and Sjogren's. She would like to ask what your experience has been with using Soclizumab for NMO, and if any data that it could help with Sjogren's as well. And while you're answering that, perhaps you can also share about how there is, you know, comorbidities exist, for example, NMO and Sjogren's or TM and lupus.
Sure. Well, I'm going to take the the second part first, the comorbidities, and then talk about the treatments. So in the setting of neuromyelitis optica, it's been recognized that easily maybe up to as much as 30% of patients may have other autoimmune conditions, and the ones that's been described include lupus and Sjogren's as well as others. And it's worth noting that this number and this feature is actually seen in a variety of conditions. Up to 30% of multiple sclerosis patients will have other autoimmune conditions. And it gets at the root of the matter, which is once you have an immune system that is prone to confusion, what it gets confused about can be variable. You could have an immune system that gets confused about the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves, in which case you get multiple sclerosis or neuromyelitis optica or transverse myelitis. Or you can have an immune system that gets confused about your joints and your kidneys, in which case you have lupus. And so, but what they share in common is confusion of the immune system. The difference between those conditions and idiopathic transverse myelitis, which tends to be a one-time event, is a critical difference because it'll yield a lot of scientific understanding about the diseases. Because in the one-time events, those patients tend not to have the same rates of autoimmune conditions. And so we really have two types of patients, patients who are predisposed to confused immune systems, and then it's just a matter of what part of their body is the target of the confusion, versus those whose confused immune system is a one-time only event. Acute disseminated encephalomyelitis or idiopathic transverse myelitis are the two best examples of that. And so it's not unusual for us to deal with patients with neuromyelitis optica who may have either a comorbid lupus or Sjogren's. And what's most common is they actually have evidence in their blood of the confusion or very mild symptoms and not full-blown lupus or Sjogren's, but rarely we do get patients with severe versions of both. There was a specific question about a treatment, Daclizumab, which is marketed in the United States under the name Xenopax. This is an antibody that targets part of the immune system's communication profile, specifically something called IL-2. And so this is a drug that has been used and FDA approved to prevent rejection of organ transplants like kidneys. It's only used in an FDA approved fashion for those kidney transplant patients. It has been studied, however, in patients with a variety of autoimmune conditions. I am not aware of any open label trials relative to neuromyelitis optica, although it has been discussed in terms of its ability to change the way the immune system activates. There are large trials within multiple sclerosis that are finishing, if not finished at this point, and we're waiting to see that data. But this is an immunosuppressant, definitely would be on the list of things to consider in individuals with neuromyelitis optica, but there is not data to suggest it yet, and definitely not FDA approval for it.
I think I may have pronounced the drug wrong. She's, I think, talking about Actemra, which is tocilizumab.
Ah, so Actemra, which is tocilizumab, works on a different part of the immune system's communication profile, specifically interleukin 6. Now, this is a drug that has been FDA approved for moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis. And so it is an FDA approved drug for a different condition. And there have been multiple publications of small numbers of patients looking at its ability to treat neuromyelitis optica, the most recent of which came out in the last month or two. Small groups of patients, under 10 patients each, that seem to have a positive response profile to the drug. Some of this work happened in Germany and some in Japan. Pathway is being actively pursued in neuromyelitis optica, and there are multiple reasons to suspect that the IL-6 pathway may be an important mediating factor in neuromyelitis optica. When considering drugs in these rare conditions, it's important to remember that all the drugs we prescribe are what are called off-label. They are not FDA-approved for these conditions. And frankly, without the controlled trials, we make our best guesses for our patients, and we are in desperate need for appropriately controlled trials so we can really sort out what works and what doesn't and what works the best so we can make better recommendations for our patients. Until then, working with your individual physicians to see which drugs in an off-label fashion can be tried is a worthwhile thing to do. And unfortunately, after a decision's been made, we also have to fight to get coverage. Because when drugs are used off-label, often there has to be a fight with insurance providers to get the drugs paid for.
That's great. Thank you. And so a few more questions on NMO. This one comes from Virginia Beach. My daughter had MS and responded to MS treatments for 12 years. In 2010, she tested negative for NMO IgG. She began breaking through her MS meds and now tests positive for NMO. How usual or unusual is it to convert from MS to NMO?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. In general, I'd appreciate Carlos chiming in, especially if he disagrees with this. In general, in cases like this, where somebody has had a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, but they weren't responding in the normal way or having attacks that seemed unusual for MS, if at any point in their history they test positive for the antibody on a reputable test, and there are some tests that can have false positives, but if I assume that it's a true positive test, then the likelihood is they didn't convert from MS to NMO. It was NMO the entire time. And there are some NMO patients that I've personally taken care of whose history really looks like multiple sclerosis, but they test positive and over time go on to clearly fulfill the criteria for neuromyelitis optica, that we started to use this term neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, meaning there are lots of ways for NMO to present, and sometimes it looks like MS. But in hindsight, which is where I think this person is relative to their daughter, it was probably NMO the entire time. And there are false negatives. So that test from a few years back may have been negative because of the technology that was being used. The original way we tested for the antibody was not as sensitive as currently used tests. So we have multiple patients who clearly had NMO. Never were confused about it, but they tested negative originally, but when we retest them today, they test positive.